episode number 88 of The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. Today's episode of The Big Web Show is sponsored by An Event Apart, the design conference for people who make websites. An Event Apart is an intensely educational two-day learning session for passionate practitioners of standards-based web design. If you care about code as well as content, usability as well as design, An Event Apart is the conference you've been waiting for. Founded by web visionaries Eric Meyer and Jeffrey Zeldman, I know that guy, and dedicated to the proposition that the creators of great web experiences deserve a great learning experience, An Event Apart brings together 12 of the leading minds in web design for 2 days of inspiration and enlightenment, plus an optional third-day workshop on multi-device design. For more information on An Event Apart, you will want to go to aneventapart.com. Aneventapart.com. Thank you, sponsor. And now, welcome, guest. Today's guest is Greg Story, president of HappyCog, designer, blogger, cigar aficionado. Did I say that correctly, or is it aficionado?
No, I think you nailed it.
I nailed it. You're sitting in your Austin office. How long? You moved to Austin about a year ago.
Yeah, in November of 2011.
And before that, you were in San Francisco?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't like the San Francisco design scene. Wasn't for you.
I would say there was times where the city kind of worked against me.
It's all the hills, isn't it?
Well, thankfully, I didn't have to walk too much. I always felt people were they were always on. You know, you were always being interviewed. If you weren't talking to somebody who was a close or a good friend, and I've heard that from other people, so I know I'm not alone. There are those who just kind of have to play the game. And fortunately for me, I didn't have to. Like, I could leave.
Tell me about the Austin scene.
Very different. It almost feels like family. When I was scoping out different cities to potentially live in, and especially Austin, just meeting people here when I would fly in from time to time, I always felt like I was already here. You know, people just made me feel very welcome and almost very familiar. And when we moved here, shortly thereafter, like weeks after, we sponsored our first Dribbble meetup. And you would have thought we had been here all along. You know, it's just a very comfortable place to live. And the people are open, honest, very laid back. At the same time, very accomplished and very professional.
Are you in the biking scene at all in Austin?
No, I'm not. And I'm trying to think. I don't think I know anybody who's in the biking scene. Nas Hamid's here. Of course, he's in the biking scene.
Nas moved there?
No, he was here a couple weeks ago. Actually, last week. I'm sorry. And was here for a couple of days hanging out.
He's a San Francisco designer, head of a small studio, co-founder of a small studio. Very talented, really nice, really nice guy.
Very nice.
How big is your – so you're doing client services work for – you're running the Western branch of HappyCog.
Now I'm running all of – well, I co-run it with Hoy. But we do have the office here in Austin, for those of us who want to live in Austin, and also be a place where people can come to work for HappyCog that don't want to live on the East Coast. And there are a lot of those people who live in the middle of the country who, they like visiting, but they don't want to live there. And our office is filled with those people. And we've just recently hired a couple people that are kind of in that mindset.
You don't think of Austin as the east coast of the Southwest?
I suppose it's like, to me, this is the furthest east before it's you're in a different country.
You're from Alaska originally.
I am.
What was that like growing up?
It was, I wouldn't trade it for much in the world. There are a lot of things that are very normal for me that are very unusual and foreign to a lot of the world.
Such as?
Well, just always being surrounded by mountains, you know, living at sea level, basically, and being surrounded by mountains that are anywhere from 7,000 to 10,000 feet or higher. Moose, you know, seeing moose, it's still a big deal. I don't get me wrong, but seeing animals that are as large or larger than your car, Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, still magical, mystical, but these were things that we saw, you know.
You were a teenager living in Alaska, mm-hmm. would you get high and look at the Aurora Borealis, or were you more of a straight-laced?
No, I was straight-laced. Plus the fact, I guess you could do that, but these things occurred almost at random. I mean, I know scientifically that's not the right way to say it, but it wasn't like you could plan on, hey, it's going to be Friday night, let's go get baked and watch the Northern Lights.
Oh, it just happens when it happens?
It happens when it happens. Yeah.
So you'd be out at church choir or basketball practice or something.
I worked.
You worked as a teenager?
Yeah. I worked from...
That's cool.
Grade school on. As soon as school? I could have... Yeah, I had a newspaper route, and that just went from newspaper route to whatever after school job, and just continued doing that until now, till where I am.
Did you ever work in a pharmacy?
I did not.
What kind of jobs, does an 8-year-old do?
Well, like I said, I did the newspaper route for probably 3 years. And that was pretty much running your own business. You had a route that you were assigned a territory, and you had to maintain what you were given. In other words, the subscribers they already had, and then it was up to you to try to go get more business. And then I also had a newspaper machine or two, a box. And I would go to the start of the route. I'd pick up all of my newspapers, my product. I would... put them in the box, and then I would start the route. And
did you fall in love with type when you were working with the newspaper as a kid?
Yeah, I think I fell in love with just news design, and type, of course, is a huge part of that. You know, type and rules. Those to this day are the core of what I enjoy, what I really like most about looking at design. And I wish we could do way more editorial design than we do now. That's just what I would have an extreme passion for.
Editorial design in the 21st century, in this new multi-device world, very, very interesting. Very challenging, and lots of new affordances.
Well, and it's interesting too, in that, you know, remember in the beginning of the web, you had editorial people, you had video people, you had people that come from almost no background, and they were all kind of vying for their format. I don't want to say to win, but you know, that definitely video people weren't looking at this and saying, hey, video, it's 1997, video on the internet sucks, so we shouldn't try to do that. I feel like we've already gone through that now. And so what I'm seeing is not necessarily people going back to their roots, you know, now that all these video is possible, different forms of content are possible. What I enjoy is seeing that people respect that with tablets and phones, people do want to read. You know, and so that I feel like that we are not having to fight that battle again, which is also exciting.
Right. The whole early premise that, or not early, just like 2 years ago, the premise 2 years ago that there was a mobile context. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lap context. And like you'd only do lap things on the lap context. And you weren't going to use your lap device for anything else. And you certainly weren't going to book your airplane on your phone, because you don't do that on a phone. It's not the mobile context, you know, and all that is gone. By the wayside, I read books on my phone and mm-hmm. make phone calls on my computer.
Yeah, there's no more lean forward and lean back. I don't know if you remember that. That was back in the turn of the century.
Lean forward and lean back. No, is that MSNBC? Who is that?
No, lean forward and lean back was the premise that people who were able to sit on a couch and look at something through their TV would spend more time focused on that thing than someone who is sitting at a desk leaning forward looking at a computer.
That's why I try to do layouts on the desktop that push your head back now. Seriously, because I spend all day squinting at these, right? I agree with what you just said. People will spend as many hours as they want to leaning forward. The amount of tension you focus on a medium has to do with the quality of the content and the engagement of that medium, you know, the content you're engaging with. But, all those assumptions are kind of, as soon as we pick one up, it goes away. I don't even know what we call what we're doing anymore.
Right. I was on Christopher Schmidt's show, Non-Breaking Space, at the end of last year. And they asked me for a couple of points, you know, kind of reflecting on 2012 and moving forward to 2013. And I ended my little segment with, when are we going to stop calling it mobile?
Right.
It's why do we even have a word for this?
Stopped calling it mobile. How about you?
I mean, I find myself still referring to it just because, you know, there's times where you need to talk about a device, but
right.
a tablet, mobile. I mean, it's hard to, I guess, break that habit.
Hand device, lap device, desk device, still.
Yeah, it's almost like you should refer to it as like screen size and not.
Yeah, but we don't want to do that.
What it is or how you do it. That's true.
And if you've seen Luke Rebluski's presentations on, I mean, that's such a continuum now, right? It's like, what's a phone? Mm-hmm. Got a 7-inch phone. So, right? Yeah. And you've got a 7-inch netbook. So which is this thing? Is it a netbook that makes phone calls? What is it?
Yeah.
Crazy. But so, yeah, I think multi-device is a nice all-purpose or, you know, touch media is another nice way of doing it, you know, touch-based.
I think one way to stop referring to the device is just to refer to what the experience is supposed to be and not care about the device. You know, is this there are times where, video, it may be a video, like a watching type of experience, or maybe a reading type of experience. And that started to kind of come up in conversation at HappyCog, where instead of when we're considering the requirements for a project, one of those is we need to design this for a reading experience, not for, you know, necessarily a user experience or a brand experience. But first we have to consider what it is that this site is trying to do. And in this case, we were talking about a project where it's a lot of text. And so it is, we're designing a reading experience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it's the context of the person instead of the context of the device.
Right. And what you're trying to do. Right.
You started HappyCog. You started as Airbag. Right?
Yes.
In Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Like 2002, something like that.
2005.
Oh, okay.
I met with you in 2003. Remember, you came to Pasadena.
Sure.
And you invited me to lunch. I called in sick at work, drove to Pasadena, And at that point, you said you need to leave your day job and go start your own thing. And I couldn't do it at the time. I was putting my wife through school. But at the next opportunity that came available, I started Airbag.
Who was your first client?
Opera Today. I don't know. Do you remember this?
Print magazine about music?
It was a blog about operas, but they wanted to do a little bit more of like magazine format. And you're the one who passed along the gig to me because they came to Happy Cog first. And you said, they had a very small budget. I want to say they had like $10,000. But they were looking for.
I don't do that.
No. I mean, and you said, we can't. You were probably busy more like it and said, but my friend Greg Story has just started. He would be really good at this. And I got the gig. And you can go see it today. I think it's still out there, operatoday.com. And it is in need of a redesign.
This is your design. I recognize it.
Yeah. I mean, it's been duct taped a bit, but.
It's still kind of, it's very beautiful, but it's so, wow. Not only should we talk about media and devices, we should talk about years. Like this type is 2005 on the web. Like type was probably a good size in the low res devices of the time.
Yeah. This was designed for 1024 by 768.
Yeah. But.
Right. And your screen, your actual physical size of the laptop or the monitor was 1024 by 768.
Right.
So type didn't look as small as it does today.
And it was also, this was still pixelated type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is Lucida Grande.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's, oh, okay. So this was the beginning of anti-aliased, of strongly. Of that next generation of anti-alias type on the web. The beautiful logo.
Yeah, that was, I actually drew that.
You drew this?
I did. I did the, I forgot what they call that instrument, but.
The Aeolian harp?
Yeah.
OperaToday.com. You did all this for this one low price?
Yeah, this was all turnkey back in 2005. This was, you got to start somewhere.
And the streaming, did they, you set that up too?
No, that was something they added a long time ago.
Okay, yeah, because the drop shadows don't look like your style. No offense
that's what I'm
to, yeah, no offense to whoever updated it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of cool. This could almost be, wow. This could almost be, it's very clearly of its time. I designed stuff that looked just like this, only not as nice. You originally approached me to design something for you. And I remember saying, this is how we ended up having that lunch. And I said, why would you hire me? You're a better designer than I am.
Yeah.
So we had lunch and, you were talking about work and I just said, that's great. But yeah, you should definitely start your own thing as soon as you can. I was very evangelical back then about, designers working for themselves. I still think you need the right mindset for it, but if you have the right mindset for it, it can be a really liberating experience. It's also stressful. I was just remembering waking up at 3 a.m. with like panic attacks because I had a client that wasn't going to pay, but I still had to pay my people.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's the, you have to be able to deal with that, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, everything comes with a price. And when it's when you're going out on your own, when you rely on yourself for your bread and butter, that is one of the high costs of doing it on your own. And I don't think that goes away. It's different for people, like what keeps them up at night, but everybody does it.
Are you less anxious nowadays in the way you've got your work environment set up now?
Yeah, with Greg and I working together more closely. And kind of having different tasks and responsibilities for all of Happy Cog. It always helps if you've got people watching your back and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And, when you're at the top all alone, you don't have that. You, you can have peer relationships, and that kind of helps talk you off the tower. But it's not the same. And I know that there's other situations where people get into partnerships and that could be stressful because they didn't set it up the right way. But I definitely don't have as much anxiety at night as I used to.
You, for a long time had folks working remotely. In fact, most of your workforce, or at least half your workforce, was remote workers at one point, but now everybody's in-house under two roofs, under three roofs, but mm-hmm. your staff is right under, you know, they're right there at hand. Do you find it that you work differently, that you work better, that the kind of work is better or different?
So, like, just to give people some background, when Airbag got started, it was completely virtual. Then we hired some people in Southern California. When we moved to San Francisco for an entire year, we were completely remote. All of us were in a different place, different space.
Your project manager wasn't in San Francisco?
No. I mean, eventually some of those people got to San Francisco, but for that first year, everybody was working out of their house. So now we're back, you know, here in Austin. I'd say we've got most of the team is here in Austin. And it's a very different vibe, you know, so I could say I've done all of the ranges of employment, virtual, all that. And, it definitely is, it's a great thing to be able to come to an office and see the people that you work with day in and day out.
It's funny because the rest of the world is moving toward the virtual model and you're finding more success the other way by going in the direction.
Well, I don't know. So success, yeah. I mean, there's definitely times where collaborating in person is a lot easier than doing it virtually. I mean, we've learned over the years, you know, since 2005, that when you work virtually, you have to over-communicate. If you're going to do it right, you can't just have a casual conversation at lunch or in the hallway and then just relay that quickly to somebody else in the same office. If you're virtual, if you and I are having this conversation and it's about work, I now have to go post that to people who our conversation may have a butterfly effect for.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so it's, I think in some ways, and I'm not alone in this observation, I think you have to work harder to work remote. You may have the freedom of schedule and, you know, work it in your pajamas or whatever shit that, you know, you think is great, but you work harder. You put in more time having to do that. And I mean, even now, even though we have the Austin office, we've got the Philly office and the New York office, you know, the teams are virtual. We have people, we definitely have people in Austin that are working together, but we've also got those same people who are working side by side with the people in Philly. You know, so the MTV OMA site that we're working on right now for this next year, one of the designers for that project is here in Austin. He would just spent a week in Philly working with those people to try to get through a bunch of work at the same time. But now he's here and he's working on what would be a virtual team. So we kind of have the best of both worlds. And I think this hybrid that we're working with right now works really well.
You're writing a book. What's that about?
Yeah, I was approached to write a book on finding or getting a job in web design.
Huh.
And they put me together with Carl Smith from EngineWorks.
Sure.
And Carl came down to Austin for South By, and we've started working on it. But we've made a couple changes. The book is going to be about finding your first job in web design. So it's really going to focus on all of the activities, the decision making and the preparation, going through the interview, even post job interview, you know, if you got the job or you didn't, and kind of leading into the first steps of a career in web design. And it's going to be written for young people to guys like me who may be going through midlife crisis and, you know, want to quit the job at the accounting firm and get into web design.
Is it about skills? Is it about the business? What's the focus?
The focus is honestly, the focus is on preparation and kind of self-selecting, knowing if this is what you want to do, and also knowing what type of job. You know, you can web design because there's essentially a low barrier to entry. Anybody can come in and say, I'm a web designer, and start freelancing. You know, it's design has always been that way, especially since the 80s when desktop publishing came in. All of a sudden, people were graphic designers because they could open up Print Shop or Aldus PageMaker and just crank out business cards.
Oh, my. Aldus PageMaker. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and so our profession has always had, like I said, pretty much low barrier to entry. And it's even more now that technology and software is cheaper. But that part of the focus will be, you know, should you really be a freelancer? There's people who should, you know, at an early age or right out of college. There's other people who probably would benefit from the structure of more of a corporate job or even a small studio like Happy Cog. So we're trying to give people an idea of what is out there in terms of potential for employment and trying to give them enough information that allows them to kind of self-select the path that they want. And then it kind of takes it from there, you know, how to get moving in those forks in the road.
Are there networks that you'll recommend in the book as well, or are there specific resources, you know, external to the book that you recommend?
There's definitely going to be networks. You know, if two or more people are getting together to talk about web design, and if you're in Wichita, Kansas, then you ought to be going to that event. You know, who knows what the quality is going to be like, but just the opportunity to meet other designers and learn what they may know, or, you know, their area of or sphere of influence. People and just getting in the habit of going to events and meeting people. I don't care how good of a designer you are. We all need as much of that experience as possible of talking to people, you know, listening, exchanging ideas, exchanging information. That never goes away. I don't care if it's your first or your 30th job in web design.
As a designer, how much research do you do on a project?
Well, I design less and less, but I'd say to some degree, it never feels enough. But on a project, there's only so much time that you're afforded to research. There's also a point where you just need to get started. You know, you can't, I think I was reading Austin Kleon's blog, the guy who wrote Steal Like an Artist. And he was talking about how at some point with him writing a book, at some point you got to get started. You always feel like you haven't researched enough, but at the same time, if you don't get going, you'll never start, right? And it's the same thing with design.
Are you a big fan of user-centered design, or are you more I know what I'm doing, I'm a designer, I'll solve the problem, thank you. That's what I went to design school for.
Yeah. As Airbag, when I started Airbag in those early years, that was more, my attitude is more of the latter. You know, and people would hire us, not everybody, but companies would hire us because they liked our design aesthetic. And so, you know, it was very comfortable to me to just crank out the work like that. And I knew it worked. I knew it was good. We never had the type of big budget projects that gave us either time to research or gave us research they may have, or let us, you know, do some user testing. That wasn't until we got to become Happy Cog that we started to be able to engage in projects like that. And I think that needs to some degree, there's going to be a balance of both. That's my personal take. You can look at research until you're blue in the face. And if you let that, as a designer, if you let research make every decision for you, then, you know, but at some point, I don't know what your role is, right? You have to bring your experience.
You don't want to be the Doug Bowman position at Google.
No. Oh. Yeah, ridiculous. Yeah.
For those who don't know, if there's anyone listening who doesn't know, Doug was a lead designer at Google, and he quit when they wouldn't trust him to pick a shade of blue. They wanted to test 47 shades because they believe in data, and that makes sense. It's an engineering-driven company. But that's, of course, one of the big debates in our whole field right now, in the whole internet right now, which is what is the role of design? You know, when we have so much data and we can, you know, if Amazon can test three different versions of Navbar in like 5 minutes and get a million results in 5 minutes, what's the purpose of having someone say, well, I learned how to design and I know how this is done and I recommend that we go this way?
Well, I think at some point, to play off your Amazon example, at some point, the role of design is to continue with that that design system, you know, learning how that system evolves over time for their specific users. And there are some designers out there that will enjoy that journey. And there's other designers out there that would just be slow death. But I think that for me personally, I will always insert my opinion into design. You know, I will always look at something and say, it's not necessarily that I don't care, but I also think at some point, the designer needs to have kind of their stamp on the work. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, honestly, I think what excites me about going back to something we talked about earlier, what excites me about where things are going in multi-devices is that what we as designers focus on is less about the whole picture and really getting into some minute detail, like making sure the typography is right. Mm. You know, if you don't have the right to typography, and I don't mean just here's my headline font, here's my body font. I mean every aspect of that typography, it's not going to be the same experience going from a Retina MacBook to an iPad mini to a BlackBerry Z10. You know, you've got to get
very
that
clearly. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to get that right. Something as part of preparing for our talk today, I was looking at, this is for my own curiosity too, just how much content is out there on the topic of design for reading. And I don't know that you'll remember this off the top of your head, but Dean Allen.
Yep. Him? Reading Design by Dean Allen, a list apart.
Yeah. You
year
got it.
2001, I think.
November 23rd, 2001. I read this.
Pretty good.
I read this last night. And this is just as relevant today, if not more. And I say if not more because back then you had, what, 6 font choices? We had Times New Roman, Georgia, Trebuchet MS, Helvetica, Arial, and I'm missing one. Maybe I'm not. Lucida Grande, once Mac OS X came out.
Yeah, no, way before then. Yeah, way before then. You had Times New Roman.
Yeah,
and
or
Courier.
Arial.
Courier New.
Courier, yep.
Courier and Arial, basically.
And if you put that, if you have that in mind when you're reading this article, that you know, he's talking here about designing for the reader, and typography is talked about. This was for a time when you had less than 10 choices for fonts. Now we have a whole entire universe. You know, we've got font book available to us. And that is both a tremendous privilege. It's a pleasure to work with, but it also creates new problems, you know, for a whole generation of designers who, you know, coming into this without having the benefit of that type of that very focused study.
Have you been reading about any of Nick Sherman's stuff on responsive typography in A List Apart?
I read the last piece, but I haven't done my own personal curiosity hasn't taken me that, you know, down that rabbit hole just yet.
Well, he's a type designer, so it has to. But yeah, this stuff makes my head hurt. The idea that we. And I love when he takes the W3C to task, too. It's like that we don't even know what a pixel is anymore. Yeah. But we can't say, well, this is a pixel. That. A lot of this. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's crazy. You know, you never know exactly how things are going to evolve. And I don't know that I'd ever imagined that we would be here with tools like Typekit and FontDeck and that ability to basically, on a Retina display, have these amazing editorial pieces.
And yet the closer we get to that kind of perfection, mm-hmm. the more we also run into all the edge cases where things don't work and all the little details and all the strange platform differences or, you know, on this version of – on these two – we literally right now have a problem with a newsletter on two Windows machines. Like two Windows machines. Nobody can reproduce it, but we don't know who else has – we don't know who else is experiencing this problem. It makes you want to go – I mean, for me, the struggle as a designer is – how much perfection and control do I want to try to harness to create this wonderful, multi-level, wonderful experience? And how much do I want to just use as many defaults as possible, like design for an optimal experience that almost that doesn't require all these things, and you know, that isn't testing for Retina without knowing bandwidth, connection speed, and all that other stuff. Just like part of me wants to get really simple.
It's pulling back and deciding what's really important. And I think that takes us back to when we're talking about a reading experience in particular. This takes us back to space, typography, maybe some rules or some, you know, some type of small symbols. And if you can get that far, if you can make sure that experience is wonderful across the board, everything else is icing on the cake.
Right. You know, color. Start there.
You start there. And it's kind of what Ethan talked about in Belfast at Build. His presentation there was, we do have the ability to throw 1,000 media queries at things and get down to this very articulate detail on making sure that across 40 devices, this thing looks, immaculate and the same. But what's the point? You know, and really, I think one of his points toward the end was kind of, in some sense, redefining what the goal is, redefining what we're trying to design for, and trying to simplify that requirement, you know, and getting those things right.
Now, you've been at this for 18 years, and you're really interested in reading experience. Do you ever look outside the web? Do you ever look at other platforms? Platforms that use the internet, but...
Yeah. So I'm very interested in what companies or publication or media companies are doing now with, like, the magazines on iPad. And even that, how that technology is evolving. So if you take a look at the Next Web, has got their magazine, and it's using a technology called Mag Plus, which is like this combination of, it's not PageMaker, InDesign. It's not the old, like, let's design pages at 300 DPI and create this 500 megabit, magazine.
Because that kind of sucked.
Yeah, that was just stupid.
By the way, we don't swear on the show, so
okay.
Just thought I'd mention that before either of us does.
So, that I think draws
Mag Plus at magplus.com.
Mm-hmm.
They did something for Mad Magazine.
Yeah, their platform is used quite a bit. But in particular, to me, and I haven't downloaded a huge amount of these, but the Next Web's the publication that they put out to me is beautiful. It's in some ways it's just as good, if not better, than the magazine. Which is awesome. I love that. But that kind of that blend of technology that's not quite HTML, but it's also not quite Objective C++. and to create these beautiful publications. A new one that is coming out is called Packager.
Oh, yes, I've heard of this.
Yeah, developed by Ben Brown, who is an Austin resident. He's the
XOXCO.com, right?
Yeah.
XOXCO.com. Packager. Oh, it's spelled like Flickr.
Sorry. Yeah. It's XOXCO.
Right. XOXCO.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so Packager, I got had a couple of demonstrations of this. These guys have created a wonderful application that takes your content, your RSS feeds, and allows you to create books, magazines, newsletters. It's hooked up to all these distribution channels that includes everything from like MailChimp to the newsstand and iOS. And it's crazy. I mean, this is kind of sort of like what I see Karen McGrain talking about to a certain level of being able to take the content agnostic of design and just hitting a button. I've watched Ben do it. He hits a button and it just like, pew, it goes out.
Is it pouring RSS content, structured content into just prefab templates, prefab responsive templates?
Yeah, exactly. And it's things like this, which aren't specifically, you know, quote web. These are exciting because this is the evolution of what everything that failed just a couple of years ago with what Condé Nast and all those guys were doing, you know, where it just was a horrible experience. And now we've got something that blends web technologies and Android, iOS, HTML5, Kindle. All this, you know, is being hit at one time using the same piece of content.
They've also got an app called Edit Shark to address the content side. But this also looks like it's something you sign up for that isn't out yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. That's kind of like, sounds like editorially.
Yeah, but I'm sure different approach, different features. Mm-hmm. I would imagine.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, as a publisher, I assume you get hit with people trying to get you to look at things like this all the time.
Yeah, but a lot of, I will tell you that, I'm sure you know this too, just like you know a client's not right for you by the way they wrote the letter.
Mm-hmm.
When someone says, we're leveraging today's technology opportunities and, you know, there's a rare synergy opportunity and we're talking to selected firms like yours. And I'm just like, you know what? I mean, if there's a lot of buzzword crunchiness in it, it's like they might have invented something. They might have invented something brilliant and hired the wrong PR people. But
yeah,
I'm just, you know, I'm still not going to check it out because there aren't enough hours in the day to check everything out. So you just have a BS detector and, you know how that works.
I do.
The same way. Go ahead.
Well, one question I wanted to make sure I asked before I forgot, because it is something it came to mind earlier today. And that was this idea of, you know, your first book was introducing the web to print designers.
Right.
You know, and how they can not only, here's what the web is, here's how it works, this is what you have to do to you know, make a web page. It was very much a transition of a roadmap to make that.
Yeah. Taking your talent to the web.com.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this morning and thinking about I think it actually would be a good idea, but why don't we have web designers not so much quit their job and go work in print, but why don't we make web designers design something in print to have to go through that process to see, you know, not only what the tools maybe look like, but that's not as important as just that discipline and the constraints. And you know, even going through the pain of a press run of some kind. And it just seems to me that, especially as we have more type available to us, our tools are getting better to create these wonderful layouts, but there's still, there isn't that background. There's not that history there of that discipline. It's it almost makes me wonder if there needs to be another version of your book, but it's like in reverse.
It's interesting because the people we're hiring, you talk about like designing less and less, managing more and more, the people we're hiring have either have the print background we didn't have or the tech background we didn't have, or they're beginning to grow up in a world where these hybrids are just can be taken for granted. There are probably people, just like most of the people we've hired in the last 10 years, never did a table-based layout. They've only done CSS layout. CSS was not something they had to be persuaded to try, and then they didn't have to unlearn 5-10 years worth of stuff. In the same way, 5 years from now, everyone we hire would just think responsively. It wouldn't even it won't occur to them to only, you know, if they do layouts in Photoshop, they'll do lots of them for the same piece of content. It won't occur to them that there's one view of any piece of content. They just they'll know because they'll take multiple devices for granted. It's wonderful because when we were their age, our clients were saying it has to look the same in every browser. Why doesn't it work the same in every browser? And now I'm imagining very few clients are asking for that because they know I don't want Facebook to look the same on my phone as it does on my desktop. So I don't want my site to look the same.
In fact, sometimes the sensitivity is almost going the other way, you know, insisting that it does have to look different.
Yeah, there's that problem too.
But yeah, you were talking about having developers and designers who never done a table-based layout. And yet at the same time, if you have to go design a newsletter for email, that's exactly what you have to do.
True.
I just read Mark Bolton's got that small book series.
Yes.
And I'm looking for it. He's got a great one on HTML email. And there's a whole section in there that talks about how to do tables and even how to do what they kind of sort of call responsive. But it's, you know, if you want an email newsletter that has two columns, you essentially have to create a parent table. And then you create your column one table that's aligned to the left and your sidebar table that's aligned to the right. And then you make the parent table liquid so that if it, you know, if you move your email window, you start collapsing it, the tables will then stand on top of each other.
It's a responsive mail layout.
But that's the only thing you can do because email, the whatever renders email views is stuck back in Outlook 97 days.
You're thinking, by the way, of the 5simplesteps.com. That's yes. Mark Bolton's book series.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Sure. That's why I wish, I hate to say it, but I wish that nobody had ever discovered HTML mail. I wish that we still just as did plain text mail.
Yeah.
And just had to use, you know, asterisks for emphasis and all that stuff. I remember like doing that and making it look really pretty too. I remember basically doing ASCII layouts of mail when Listapart was a newsletter, right? Before
like,
it was
a listserv, right?
I mean, when it was a listserv and you'd insert carriage returns.
Yeah.
And all that stuff to make sure that it formatted correctly on everyone's 600 by 400 monitor screen.
Yep. Wow. But yeah, tables, it's funny. When I was reading the book on HTML and seeing this kind of quote hack, and it made me realize there's people that even at HappyCog who have never coded with a table. And I talked to one of them specifically and pointed this out and said, do you have you ever done this before? And she had never, ever used a table at all, which that kind of floored me.
It's great. The kids today,
we
churned our own butter.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we go, do you want to talk just a little bit about this digital PM summit that you're working on?
Yes. So the digital, let me step back. In the fall of 2012, our project management director, Brett Harnad, came to Greg Hoy and I and said, I think there's an opportunity here to create an event for project managers. And we kind of talked about it and did some research and kind of realized that, oh yeah, we have events that are dedicated to design and development, some more so than others, but there's very light on content about project management. And that's fine. It doesn't mean you have to fix that, but we saw that there might be an opportunity. So we put out a survey. We had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people respond to that survey, project managers, shop owners, designers, and it became quite clear that the world wanted this. And so we've been at work. We came back from Christmas break and started work and just announced this week the Digital PM Summit. It's going to take place in Philadelphia. Let me get the in Philadelphia on October 14th and 15th. There's only going to be 150 tickets. We want to limit this just to make sure that we get this event right. We've got the right combination of speakers and conversations. And I'm looking forward to this a lot just because I know it's going to meet the needs of a lot of project managers out there, a lot of teams who are looking for new ideas on different processes and different way to interact with clients and get things done.
A small event? 100 people, 500 people, 50 people? Do you know?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
What size event?
It's going to be limited to 150.
Okay.
So right now, the teaser site, which is at dpm2013.com, and it's really kind of to save the date, introduce what this is, to save the date, and also to sign up for the email. Will there be ribs? I don't know if there's going to be ribs.
Bacon?
We're gonna have, the definitely will be bacon. I think we've just signed the contracts for the caterer, and I think it'd be okay to announce that this is going to be catered by Iron Chef Garces, who is a restaurateur in the Philadelphia area. It makes amazing food, and the menus for breakfast and lunch for this thing are going to be amazing, absolutely amazing.
Cool.
So we're going to open up registration to the people who subscribe to our email first. So with only 150 tickets, there's only so many tickets out there. And if this is something you want to go to, definitely subscribe to the email because I think they're going to go quick.
DPM2013.com.
Yep.
Greg Story, always a pleasure, sir. And a pleasure having you on the show today.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, we should do it more often.
Yeah.
Have a great Austin afternoon.
Thank you.
And I will see you very soon.
All right. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye, everybody.